Side here. Guess we still have my notes on the board. Let me re-summarize. Where was it that I left off? So we just had some R's and S's showing up. All right, let me recap this on the left side here, find some space. Maybe I'll restart on middle board and then summarize everything you need to remember from this morning. What it is that the StreamCypher Salsa 20 is doing for us. What do we need to remember from this morning? So the sender and receiver have a shared secret K, and in particular the receiver has a secret K, which is only a 256-bit string. Now, no matter how many messages are being authenticated, what does the receiver do when he gets a message? The receiver no longer stores R's and S's. The receiver just stores this 256-bit K. Given some message from the network, I'm putting in primes as usual to indicate that these are things which the attacker might have controlled, might have modified. Hopefully it's a valid message number, nonce n, valid nth message m, and then a should be computed in the usual way. Taking the secret k, Salsa 20 expands k in a randomly accessible way into 512-bit quantities, well, into 512 times whatever, 512 times some gigantic number of blocks, and we can randomly access those blocks, compute a 512-bit Salsa 20 of the secret key k, that's one input, and then the block number is exactly the message number, n prime. And out of this n prime block, 512-bit block of the Salsa 20 output, view 256 bits of that as Rn and Sn. Extract 256-bit R sub n. Let me be careful. We don't know what the n legitimately was, if there was one, but we extract a 256-bit, 128-bit R followed by 128-bit S, and then use those with Pauli 1305 to authenticate, to check, recheck the authenticator of this message. We check whether A prime is equal to M prime, evaluated at this R, plus F, with M prime of R being evaluated mod 2 to the 130 minus 5, and the plus S being mod 2 to the 128, etc. Along with the receiver checking that n prime is a reasonable nonce, that it's not smaller than the last nonce of the message actually, or equal to the nonce of the last message actually accepted, this will guarantee that messages come in the right order, and you still have to deal with what if a message is dropped, if messages come in out of order, and you reject the subsequent message as being earlier than the preliminary one, have to ask the sender to send it again. Lots of strategies for ensuring that messages are delivered in order, but this achieves the basic feature of protecting against forgery. If A prime, M prime, and N prime are not something that was authenticated by the legitimate sender, then the receiver will detect it at this point, assuming Salsa 20 is secure, assuming that this R and S are unpredictable, that N prime, as n prime varies, the r's and s's look like they're all independently, uniformly chosen. All right. What is the security level here? Well, we conjecture it's the same as Pauli 1305. What else do I have to say about this? Ah, yes, the speed. To remind you of what I was saying before about Salsa 20 speed, well, for every byte generated by Salsa 20, there's some cost, say 12 or 14 cycles per byte. And if we compute 64 bytes, 512 bits, then multiplying 12 by 64, we get something like 800 cycles to generate R and S. And that's to be compared to the cost of doing Pauli 1305, this message evaluation, which was lots of multiplications by R. And assuming we have, say, a 1500 byte or even only a 1024 byte message, then the dominating cost here is Pauli 1305. Although there is a noticeable extra cost for Salsa 20, you shouldn't just ignore the several hundred cycles. I wrote this down before, that somewhere here was the cost of salsa 20, which depending on your computer is between 300 and 900 or maybe 250 to 950 cycles depending on your CPU. And then the cost of Poly 1305 is maybe 4 to 8,000 cycles depending on your CPU, so you might notice several hundred extra on top of that. It's not something to completely ignore, but Poly 1305 is certainly the dominating cost if you're just authenticating messages. But that if is not always true. The SALSA 20 speed, the speed of whatever stream cipher you're using, is much more important if you're encrypting data. If you have to generate a lot more secret stuff for each message, not just R and S, if you had, for instance, a long R, like in UMAC, you have to expand your secret into a lot of, say, 1024 bytes of R. Or if you want to encrypt for the highest speed mechanisms we have for producing these secrets, you still need to produce enough secrets to encrypt your entire message, which means as many secrets as the length of your message. Suppose that you have an L byte message using little l here for the number of bytes, as opposed to my big L has typically been the number of chunks of a message. If little l is the number of bytes in your message, then you need a 16-byte 128-bit R and a 16-byte F. And those, when L gets big, pale beside the cost of generating L bytes of what I've been calling T's. L byte T to add to M. How many blocks of SALSA 20 output do we need? Well, there's L plus 32 bytes. Multiply that by 8 for the number of bits. Divide by 512 for the number of blocks. Comes out to the ceiling of L plus 32 divided by 64, 512-bit, SALSA 20 blocks. What does that mean for the total cost of encrypting and authenticating a message? Well, as L gets big, basically this is L over 64-byte blocks. So whatever the cost of SALSA 20 was per byte, you take that cost. Let me start with the Poly 1305, which we're also going to have to do. Poly 1305 cycles per byte plus the SALSA 20 cost here, the SALSA 20 cycles per output byte. Adding those together, that's incurred for every byte of the message times L. For instance, 1024-byte message, if we're spending, say, 5 cycles per byte on Poly 1305 for authentication and 12 cycles per byte for SALSA 20 for encryption, then that's a total of 17 cycles per byte for authenticated encryption, and that's for times 1024 bytes for the message. Plus, there's some startup costs. There's the per-message overhead. Even if you have a tiny message, then there's things like this L plus 32 instead of just L, and the ceiling up to rounding up to 64 bytes per block, and then Poly 1305 has its initialization and cleanup. There's some per-message overhead, which you should pay attention to. If you don't pay any attention to the per-message overhead, then you end up choosing cryptographic functions which reduce the number of cycles per byte at the expense of a huge overhead, which for any practical value of L means you notice the overhead much more than the cycles per byte. But if you put some reasonable effort into the overhead, as SALSA 20 and Poly 1305 do, then it's, say, 1,000 cycles at most, plus L times some number of cycles per byte, and if L is, say, 1024 or 1500, typical bulk internet packets, then that's going to be, the cycles per byte is going to be dominant. And you can see here the importance of selecting a stream cipher. It's a pretty big addition to the 4 or 5 or 3 or 8 cycles per byte for Poly 1305. If we have to add in, say, 14 cycles per byte, even on the fastest CPU for SALSA 20, 4 cycles per byte, more typically 8, it's certainly a lot faster to scale SALSA 20 down to just, say, 5 or 6 cycles per byte. If you chose a slower stream cipher that took 15 or 20 or 25 cycles per byte, then, well, you're maybe doubling the total cost of your encryption and authentication, assuming you're using encryption. Again, the speed situation is totally different depending on whether you're just generating RNS for authentication or you're generating a ton of data, as long as your message, for encrypting the message. One more way to evaluate the speed here, let me mention denial of service attacks. Or, well, not the general concept of denial of service attacks, but one particular denial of service issue. If you don't care about denial of service, if you don't care about someone flooding you with work, then you can skip this slide, pane of the blackboard. But, okay, the issue is the following. Suppose somebody forges a message and sends it to you, knowing that, okay, you're going to reject it, but you're going to have to consume CPU time to reject it. If you burn CPU time for Poly 1305, do you also have to decrypt? Do we have to decrypt a forged packet? Now, if you ignore the cost of generating secrets for encryption and decryption, then it might seem like the time for encryption, just an exclusive OR, is very, very fast, and this isn't a concern. But the system that I've described, if you're paying attention to the amount of time to generate streams, which you should, because SALSA 20 for encrypted authentication is an even bigger cost than Poly 1305, then you really have to look at this. And, well, the system that I've described for authenticated encryption combining a one-time pad with Poly 1305 looks like you take chunks of your message, let me just call them M1, well, let me express M as C1, C2, etc. Suppose that you take the first chunk of your message, C1, and add some T1 to it, and then the second chunk of your message and add some T2 to it, all mod, say, 2 to the 128, and then at the end of all that, after CL plus TL, suppose you stick on the authenticator, which is M of R plus F. This is what I described for combining a one-time pad with Poly 1305 authenticator. And in this case, you have to go ahead and subtract the T's. You have to compute the T's before you can check the authenticator. If you want to compute M of R plus S, then you need to figure out M to feed as input to the polynomial evaluation. And that requires taking these sums, which are sent through the network. The receiver has to take these sums and subtract off the T's. So the answer to the question, do we have to decrypt the packet, is yes. You need to compute the T's in order to, I'll say before, although, well, you could start with the first few T's and the beginning of the M evaluation, but you need to compute all the T's in order to complete the computation of M of R. Compute the T's, subtract them from the ciphertext you've received, C1 plus T1, etc. That gives you the putative C1, C2, and so on. Evaluate those at R. So you have to compute all the T's first. And this is a totally unnecessary cost. You get exactly the same security and better speed from this denial of service perspective by changing the M plus T comma, so M plus T meaning that C1 plus T1, C2 plus T2, etc., followed by the authenticator. Instead of encrypting M and authenticating M, where the authentication also has its own kind of encryption, instead of that, you send an authentication of the encryption. The formulas here are maybe simpler than the word explanation. You take M plus T and then evaluate that encrypted message at R plus S. Take your message M and then XOR it or add it to whatever secret data, T1, T2, and so on, produced by SALSA 20. And then that gives you a new message of the same length, a ciphertext that nobody can understand. Authenticate that ciphertext by evaluating that at R and adding S. And now what does the receiver have to do? If he gets this pair, along with a message number determining R and S, then he figures out R and S, and he does not have to subtract T before he checks the authenticator. He can just take the M plus T, or the M prime, whatever's sent through the network, evaluate that at R and see if it matches. And that's not going to match unless it was one of the messages sent by the legitimate sender, or the attacker got extremely lucky. We have the same security guarantee for this as we do for basic poly 1305, and then combined with FALSA 20 have the security conjecture, which follows from the conjectured indistinguishability of FALSA 20. This method of encrypting and authenticating has the very logical name of encrypt then authenticate. This is one of the rare cases where I'm very, very happy with the standard terminology in the literature. This is one of the best chosen terms I've ever seen in cryptography. First you encrypt the message, and then you authenticate it. And there's some papers which compare this from theoretical perspectives to authenticate, then encrypt, and authenticate and encrypt, and there's various variations here, but the clear winner from a speed perspective is encrypt, then authenticate, and they're all just as secure if you apply them to, say, poly 1305 and FALSA 20, then you might as well use encrypt, then authenticate. All right. At this point, I think it is time for me to show you FALSA 20. I've said all these things that FALSA 20 does. Before I go through the definition, which is very simple sequence of operations, just a very long sequence of operations, but fortunately repeats itself, so I'll just have to get you used to it and then say, okay, repeat this 20 times. Before I jump into that, any last questions about what it is that a stream cipher like FALSA 20 is doing for us? The speed constraints and the security constraints. Okay. Don't see any particular hands. So let's jump into the definition. Now this is from back in May 2005, gave a talk introducing FALSA 20. And let me see if I can focus this a bit better so we can actually see the bits running around. Focus minus. Oops, made it worse. Focus plus. All right, that's looking pretty good. So what is happening here, aside from the dark gray square that didn't appear last time I showed these slides, what's happening here? So there's a key. You know there's a 256-bit key that comes in. And here's the key in blue. And this is a key which has a string of 16 bytes, has a ridiculously simple structure. Of course, you'd have to be very unlucky to choose this particular key. But okay, for following through the computation, we might as well use this key 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All my bytes here are in binary. You can see the individual bits. 1, 0, 0, 0, that's a 1. 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, that's a 2. And then 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, that's a 3, and so on. So there's the key, 16 bytes, 128 bits, which as bytes are counting 1 through 16. And then there's a nonce, a message number, which is only 8 bytes. There's also a block counter, which is another 8 bytes. So actually the n that I've been talking about you can view as the nonce here and have a block counter of 0, or have a 16-byte n if you want, which means that the big n I was talking about, the number of blocks of output of FALSA 20 for one key, is 2 to the 128. And that's certainly more than you need for any practical application. Let's just take this 8-byte nonce and plug it into FALSA 20. So what happens? First, just concatenate the key. Here, I've taken the key, and what's happened to the key? Well, the key, you can see, actually, what's happened here? Wait, let's count the key size. This is just using a 128-bit key. Now, I described FALSA 20 as using 256, but it has this option for taking a 128-bit key and repeating it, which is not what I recommend, but, well, it's what my example here uses for a small key. So this 128-bit key is actually repeated twice in that 4x4 array that you see up at the top right. You can see if you look at the blues on the top row, you can see the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 in binary. You can see the first three quarters of the key are in the top row of that array, along with some darker blackish diagonal word, which is some constant that I'll get to in a moment. And then the fourth quarter of the key is in the second row at the beginning. And then there's another constant. And then some red numbers. The reds are the nonce and the block counter. So those are different inputs, n. And then there's another darkish, blackish constant. And then the key is repeated. If you have a 256-bit key, then you fill in the key in the same blue spots instead of repeating a 128-bit key. I was submitting this to eStream, the eCrypt Stream Cipher project, which required that you support 128-bit keys. And also, it's convenient for the example to have a shorter key. So you can see here the key is repeated as 1 through 16 compressed into four chunks of 32 bits, and that's what appears on the third and fourth rows in blue of the 4x4 matrix up at the top. What the gray squares covering it, saying diagonal entries are constants. Along the diagonal of the 4x4 matrix, there's just some constants. If you look at them in ASCII, those constants say expand 16 byte key, or expand 16 byte K. Count letters there to figure out where it's truncated. It's just some constants. Doesn't really matter what the constants are, aside from there's certain choices of constants which are maybe a little bit bad. So those constants satisfy certain, avoid certain nasty properties. But basically, it's arbitrary constants, which I chose to be memorable. And then the red entries in the 4x4 array, that's the N. Okay. There's basically just one operation that happens in Salsa 20. And let me try shifting this one to a copy of that, and this one to the next. Okay, so now you can see the original array on the left, 4x4 array, and on the right, there is a modification that has happened to the array, which consists of, you can see in the on the right side there, almost everything's the same except for one dark black word below the diagonal that's changed. It's above the big gray square there. You can see one red word has changed to a black word. The colors are not maintained inside the computer. They're just for my illustration here. Thanks to Tanya for suggesting that I use colors for these slides. The underlined words that you see above the black word, the one that's new, that has changed, what the text says there is the modification is very simple. Add two underlined words, and then you can read the rest, it's not covered by the black, by the gray square. You add the underlined words, which are above what's being modified. You rotate left by 7 bits within 32 bits. All my examples in terms of bits are little endian, so when I say left, it's a little tricky that left actually means towards, the standard interpretation of the phrase rotate left is rotate towards high bits, which actually is towards the right in this picture, but well. The code should make everything quite clear. If the array is x bracket 0, x bracket 1 is one of the underlined words, 2, 3, that's on the top row, and then 4, 5, 6, 7 on the next, and 8, 9, 10, 11. X bracket 9 is being modified by being in C notation XORed with, you XOR into x bracket 9, the sum of x bracket 1 and x bracket 5, mod 2 to the 32, and then less 7 is the standard notation for rotating left, rotating towards high bits, by 7 bits, multiplying by 2 to the 7 mod 2 to the 32 minus 1, basically. Although, well, be careful about how you handle the exactly equal to 2 to the 32 minus 1. There's one problem with this line. If you actually feed it to a C compiler, it will say, wait a minute, less is not standard C. Less for a shift is standard, but less for a rotate, that's a common notation in cryptography that most compilers haven't actually adopted yet. I have also on these slides, I gave credit to TEA, the tiny encryption algorithm, which is a prior algorithm with a very similar flavor, although kind of smaller, lower security level, smaller input. All right, so that basically is the only kind of modification that happens, although the positions where it happens, the numbers involved change. So let me show you the next modification. Actually, before I get to that, is everyone clear on what the first modification to these 16 32-bit words is? This would be, go ahead. What arithmetic? Well, okay, so I've got 32-bit numbers, x bracket 1 and x bracket 5, and the correspondence of those to the array is you take the underlined numbers and view them as, you can see the dark blue as opposed to, if you look at the first underlined word on the right side, maybe I could highlight this with the mouse. So this word right here has, on the left, you see a darker spot, that's a 1, and then 2, 4, 8, et cetera, are skipped, and then at some point you get to a, I guess that would be bit 512, 1 plus 512 plus skip 1024, 2048, et cetera, and at some point you get to, I guess it's 65536, and then 131072, add those up, and then add whatever the next one is, and that gives you a 32-bit number between 0 and 2 to the 32 minus 1, and then add that to the one below it, and XOR the result, or rotate the result. Left is, unfortunately, the standard notation for rotating that way pictorially, since I've got little endian. So rotate that way by 7 bits, and then XOR into the next word down. And XORing into, you can see the original X bracket 9 was 32 0 bits, so the result there, the new black word, is, I claim, exactly the rotated left by 7 sum of these two words. And you can actually do that if you add in your head this bit and those bits. There's no carries there. It's just a big clump of black, black, white, black, black, which is exactly what you see 7 bits later inside the black word. And similarly, that bit and those bits add together to form the clump here, and that chunk turns into that chunk, and these two turn into those two. And you can see that adding these words and then rotating left by 7 bits produces exactly the black word there. If there had been any bits set in the red word, then those would have been XORed into the result, to the black word here. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but I want to make clear what the construction of the black bits is from the underlined bits and the previous red bits. Let me pause. So what... Oh, well, what I was saying about rotation, so rotating left by 7 means, precisely, that you multiply by 2 to the 7 mod 2 to the 32 minus 1. Except that when you have exactly 0 or 2 to the 32 minus 1, you preserve whether you were 0 or not. So rotating left by 7 means multiply by 2 to the 7, reduce mod 2 to the 32 minus 1. These are 32-bit words. And then if you have a 0, go back to your original, and if your original was not 0, then your output is also not 0. It'll be 2 to the 32 minus 1. So that's what rotate left by 7 means. It means, in terms of the individual bits, you just take your bits and shift each bit 7 positions over, wrapping around at the end. The difference between a shift operation, which I've described, is multiplication by 2 to the 7 mod, say, 2 to the 32 in this case. I previously described shifts for 2 to the 64, but in this case, 32-bit words, shifting left by 7 would be multiplying by 2 to the 7. Rotating left by 7 means you take what you take the quotient when you divide by 2 to the 32, and then divide that by 2 to the 32 and add it into the remainder, and that gives you the rotation. Then the XOR operation here is the familiar 32-bit exclusive OR, which I've described previously. Have I answered your question at this point? Okay. All right, moving on to the next modification. So we've modified one black word before, and now we modify three other words, which work in exactly the same way that there are now four black words, each of which was obtained from the previous whatever was in the same position, by XORing a left rotated by 7 bits sum of the two words above. The part covered by the gray square says columns wrap around from bottom to top. So if you're working above, for example, the top right black spot here, then that gets input fed in from, these are the blue and green, or blue and whatever color it looks like, blue and gray on the projector. Those are the words above the black word here. So those two are added together, rotated left by 7 bits, and XORed with the top right blue here to form the new top right of the array is the black word there. And similarly in every column. I already did the second column, and similarly do the first, third, and fourth with exactly the same rotation distances, just feeding in different inputs. Each word gets two words above it. Each word just below the diagonal gets the two words above it added together, rotated left by 7, and then XORed into it. All right, so at this point we've modified four words, which of course has not hidden very much of the input, but we continue modifying. We now move down to the sub-diagonal, and instead of rotating by 7, rotate by 9. If you think there's some magical mystery quality to the 7 and 9, let me assure you there's not. It's just pretty much random numbers. There's a few numbers like rotating always by 0 would be a bad idea, but basically 7 and 9 are just as good or bad as any other number, pretty much any other number. So what's happened here is now you can see in the second column, for example, take the diagonal word and the first word that I changed right below it, and then add those together and XOR that into the blue word on the bottom row, second column, producing a replacement for that blue on the bottom second column, and that's the new black word there, is the XOR of the blue word with the rotated by 9 bits sum of the two words above it. And, well, here's the code, which is more concise description than anything else, although you should see pictorially what the indices are referring to. Here's the software that says, take your two words of the array, add them, mod 2 to the 32, rotate left by 9 bits, producing 32-bit result, which you replace x bracket 8 by its XOR with that rotated result. All right, and then you continue, leave the 9 on the left, and do one more rotation going down, proceeding down each column. So now we've modified in the first column, we started by modifying the word right below the diagonal, and then we modified the word right below that, and now we add those two results, rotate left by 13 bits, and then XOR into the result below it. And same thing in each column. You can see there's still the diagonal words have been untouched after these 12 modifications, but finally we continue down with a rotation distance of 18 in this case, and now we've modified every word of the array. After 16 word modifications, everything has at least nominally changed somehow. Every word has been touched, which doesn't mean that the output looks particularly random. But we continue. So now that you've seen some column rotations, got these backwards. All right, so after modifying all the columns, now you modify the rows, and now do 16 more modifications proceeding along the rows just by transposing what just happened to the columns. Before, the columns were modified once, wrapping around, and now the rows are modified once, wrapping around. So the rows and columns are talking to each other somehow. Each entry of the matrix has some opportunity to interact with other entries of the matrix. Well, if you look carefully at exactly what communication has happened at this point, you see we don't have a complete graph yet, but at least there's been some communication across columns, some communication across rows, after 32 modifications of words. And now each 16 modifications, the first 16 changes of words, that's one round of salsa 20, which, as I've said, has 20 rounds. The row modifications are the second round, and now you go back to column modifications. And, well, okay, the bits at this point are looking completely incomprehensible. I'm not claiming they're cryptographically secure. I don't expect you to get more out of the pictures at this point, but the text says every word's been modified 3 times. There's 48 modifications. That's 3 rounds, and then 4 rounds, and you keep going this way for 20 rounds. You modify the columns, as I started with, then the rows, then the columns, 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 then the rows, halfway, and then you keep going 20 rounds total. And then the gray square is covering what says first block. Maybe I should comment here that the output, after doing all these modifications, you should not take this resulting 16 words, resulting 512 bits, and just output it as the salsa 20 result. What's happening here is taking that final result plus the original result. Plus is again being mod 2 to the 32. What would go wrong if I didn't add the original result? What's wrong with taking the result of these 320 modifications and just saying that is salsa 20 of k, n, aside from it's getting the definition wrong? Yeah. It's reversible. Yeah, everything that's happened here is invertible. You can just run the computation backwards. The most basic feature that salsa 20 should achieve is that you can't just run the computation backwards and take salsa 20 k, 0, say, and work backwards to k. And everything that I've done until the final addition stated on the slide, everything that I've done in modifying this array is something you can undo. When I XORed into a word some function of some other word, some rotated sum of other words, then that's something you could undo. As long as you undo the whole sequence of that starting from the end, then you get back to the beginning. You see the original array, and in particular, you see the key, k. So that would not be good, but that's easily stopped by adding the key again at the end. And, well, very simple way to get the key and some other useless stuff, but it's easier to do the software this way and not a serious bottleneck. Just add the whole original array. Take Z here's notation for the final array and X is notation for the original, or maybe the way I was writing the software before, Z should be the original one, but anyway, add the original array to the final array, and in particular, you're adding the key again, and that's not something that the attacker can predict. So the first block of salsa 20 output is the sum of the key and nonce and so on that we started with, and the final array after 20 rounds, in other words, 320 modifications. The last comment on the slide here is that if you want more blocks, then you can increase the block counter. If you want many blocks all at once, then this is all parallel, but okay, I've emphasized already the random accessibility of SALSA 20 output. Overall, there's 2 to the 128 blocks that you can get if you want them. Obviously, nobody's going to count that far, but it's convenient to have, for instance, your n is a 64-bit number, and then for any particular n, you might have a bunch of t's, and that's where you might use the block counter, 64-bit block counter, as well as the 64-bit n. Okay, there's still some more slides here, because I want to illustrate what happens if you compare the results from one round to the results for a different block. But before I get into that, is the definition clear? It's maybe a little more complicated than what you should memorize seeing the very first time, but at least the structure of it, you should feel like, yeah, okay, you know what operations are being used here. There's the XOR into words in some pattern, sums, rotated sums of two other words. And then keep going, and at the end, add to your original, well, and, most importantly, add your original key, but also just add the whole original 4x4 matrix, and that gives you 512 bits. That seems hard to work backwards. Okay, don't see any particular questions, so let me say what would happen if you changed a little bit in n, or you change a little bit in the block counter. Change one of those red words. Okay, suppose that you move on to block 1. Now, I've got a completely different looking array here with just one isolated bit. What I'm showing here, the new pictures, are not the arrays actually manipulated by SALSA 20, but these are differences between the original array for block 0 and the original array for block 1. If you change n by one bit from 0 to 1, or change the block counter, whatever, change one of the red words by 1, then the XOR between that and the new, between the new one and the old one, is exactly this one bit shown here. If you XOR the pictures I'm drawing now with the pictures before, you'll get the pictures actually drawn for block 1. Okay, so that's the starting array. And now, after one round, what was it that happened in the first round? Let's remember. We modified the sub-diagonals by adding the two words above. So we modify, first of all, let's see. We take, here's the diagonal. We modify the word below the diagonal, which originally is this word, the second row, first column, by adding the one above it, the diagonal word there, and the one here, and XORing them, rotating, and XORing into that word. And that doesn't change the word at all. It has the same effect for block 0 and for block 1. There are no differences in any of the words that I just pointed to for the first modification. And then we take that result and add it to the diagonal, and whatever the, so those are things that are also the same in block 0 and in block 1, and rotate and XOR into the third row, first column here. And that produces, since the third row was this one bit different to begin with, it's still one bit different after XORing the same thing into it. And then we modify the bottom, and here, as a result of the rotation by whatever number of bits, you can see there's been a little bit of carrying, which is why the one bit difference has spread out into a few bits. And then one more operation has combined these bits and rotated a bit and maybe done another carry, and the result of that is a few bits are different after one round. If you stop SALSA 20 after one round, all the words were modified in the first round. But if you look at SALSA 20K0 versus SALSA 20K1, they have only a tiny little difference if we had just one round. What the text says is the difference has propagated to two other words in the same column. Depends on a few carries, but still highly predictable. The difference between SALSA 20K0 after one round and SALSA 20K1 after one round would have no differences in most of the columns, and just a few differences in the first column, which is why we keep going for more rounds. And here you can see the change after two rounds, where starting from the differences in the first column, those spread into differences in the first row, and the third row and the fourth row all get modified in various ways. The second one, there's no differences, so the second row still looks the same between block 0 and block 1. And then continuing to the third round, suddenly every word is touched after three rounds. There's some terminology here. What's under the gray is every word has been affected, a substantial fraction of bits are now active. Active means that a bit is something different, or at least potentially different, between the block 0 results and the block 1 results. And if you look at a substantial fraction of the 512 positions, you see there are, in fact, differences. In fact, almost every bit in the picture has a chance of being affected, although some of them are still unlikely to be affected, like the stretches of zeros and the differences here. That's not an accident. You would have to have a lot of surprising carries to get a difference between block 0 and block 1 after 3 rounds in those positions, which is why we continue to more rounds. After 4 rounds, okay, after 4 rounds, there's no particular stretches of inactivity. And then the text says hundreds of active bits in every subsequent round. If you look at all 20 rounds, there's something like 4,000 active bits. At least conjecturally, it appears that for every, if you look at all differences, for all the 2 to the 128 possible red inputs, and look at how, if you made any sort of change to those, then what would that do in subsequent rounds? Maybe there's some cancellation between some changes, but it appears, and to a limited extent this can be proven, but it appears that in general, there are always lots and lots and lots of bit differences between the block n and the block n sub 2 results, for any n and any n sub 2. Now, trying to prove something like this, let alone any sort of security conjecture, is way beyond what we can do. If you limit the statement enough, then you can prove things. There are theorems about branch numbers, for example, which are statements about how many active bits or active words there are in various ciphers, but those don't guarantee any sort of security. It's just a way of capturing the intuition that there's lots of differences between what happens in block 0 and what happens in block 1 or any pair of blocks. And those differences are all affected by some carries, which all depend, almost all of them depend on the key, which the attacker doesn't know. So he can't predict exactly where there's going to be zeros and where there's going to be ones, intuitively, maybe. Well, this is the rough intuition for why there's lots and lots and lots of differences in SOLVE for 20. Of course, for a mathematician, it can be kind of unsatisfying to have absolutely no proof. I think that was the end of my slides. Oh, yeah, I had some speed comments in that talk. But this was for showing you what SOLVE for 20 does for a block and what it does for the next block, which after 4 rounds ends up looking considerably different. And then I have some more pictures. Here we go, SOLVE for 20 diffusion. So, okay, what are we looking at here? What the text says in small type is here's a typical input array with a superposition of 256 possibilities for the first byte in the third row. So before I was showing what happens if you have 0 or 1 as the block counter here. And you can see a lot of zeros. What this picture is the same 4x4 array where there's 128 bits in the first row, 128 in the next, 128 in the next, 128 in the next. Ignore the fuzz here. The stretched vertical lines are just single bits, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, etc. In the bottom row here. And those are divided into 32-bit chunks for making a 4x4 array. Now what's happening in the left here is some sort of quantum superposition of 256 possibilities, 0 through 255, for the first byte of the block counter. So these pictures are going to show all 256 results of SOLVE for 20 computation after several rounds, well, after 1, 2, 3, and so on rounds, if you start with block counters 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. And now you should be able to recognize that in this one round picture, it's very much like the picture I was showing after one round before, that a difference in the first byte, SOLVE for 20 percolates differences through the first column, affecting some part, after some rotation, some part of the word in the bottom left here. You can see that depending on the initial bytes might have some surprising carries extending over into some more bits, but most of the time there's effect within the kind of left part of whatever byte this is here, or within the bits where you see the most fuzz, and then there's some percolation of effects with still kind of predictable structure up into the top left. And then the second round takes those differences. Maybe let me just pause and make sure it's absolutely clear what the picture is showing here. There are, in each of these rows, what I'm holding my hand around here is 256 rows of bits. And the rows are, of course, almost all identical. You can see visually that all the bits are 0 here, all the bits are 1 here. But on the left, there's all the possibilities for the top left bit of the SALSA 20 array for that initial byte being 0 through 255. And then the next bit is always a 0. I can see by looking closely the next bit is always 1. The next bit varies between 0 and 1 depending on what your byte was. All right. The 4x4 array, the 512 bits times the 256 possibilities, after two rounds end up looking like what's shown here. The differences percolate through the rows, although certainly not completely, even within the rows that have been affected, and then there's one row that has not been affected at all. After three rounds, you can still see some definite non-randomness. There's a lot of hard-to-predict structure here, but there's definitely some spots where you can look at this and say, okay, those bits are unlikely to be affected. In fact, there's some bits here that are just always the same between the, when we go through the SALSA 20 computation, then no matter what the block counter was, all of these bits that I'm pointing to are the same. This bit is always a 1, this next bit is always a 0. No matter what the block counter was. If we use the output at that point, it would be quite predictable. It would be the same. It would be this huge correlation between the bits of the block. After four rounds, you can't see any structure anymore, although you can still detect some correlations with a computation that takes some time. And, well, I kept going with these pictures for a few more rounds, and SALSA 20 goes for 20 rounds. When I was designing it, my goals were to, first of all, beat AES from a speed perspective and massively beat AES from a security perspective. Say, all right, there's going to be, first of all, a bigger key than people normally use for AES, although AES does have a slow 256-bit option, to have the output being big blocks which are indistinguishable from uniform without the indistinguishable from different uniform blocks that AES has, which is a serious wart if you start looking at, say, 2 to the 50 blocks. And then to give people some confidence that 20 rounds is overkill, that they don't need the 20 rounds, but okay, in case anybody manages to detect patterns after 4 rounds, 5 rounds, 6 rounds, well, we're still way beyond that. 20 rounds, I thought about attacks, ways to detect patterns in this picture, or not just 256 different blocks of output, but whatever number of blocks of output. And I couldn't see any way to even get to 10 rounds, let alone 20. So I said, all right, here's 20 round SALSA 20, which raises the question of what sort of attacks people have come up with. And I think that brings me to more stuff to write on the blackboard. Absolutely. Question? Well, again, there's a certain transition from three rounds. You just draw the picture, and anybody can see that there's non-randomness in it. After four rounds, it's hard to see, but then you start throwing the computer at it and saying, computer, what can you see in the picture? Using standard statistical tests, you can still see non-randomness there. And then you can start combining some thought about what exactly SALSA 20 does with some computer analysis. And I want to tell you what the results of that are. So I have some, quite a few comments on the attacks that people know on SALSA 20, but let me just pause. Are there more questions about the pictures here? Well, remember the security conjecture. What we conjecture is that the output here is just the, this is still something invertible, but then you add this to the original arrays, which is no longer apparently an invertible function. Well, it might be, but it's not obvious that it is. We don't know how to compute the inverse of that. Anyway, the conjecture is that you can't tell the difference between the outputs for all the blocks that you feed in, all the block counters in. If you're not told what K is, and somebody just gives you SALSA 20, K0, K1, and so on, or somebody gives you a uniform random string of the same length, then you can't tell the difference. That's the conjecture. And then an attack, a distinguisher for salsa 20, would be something that does say, yes, these are salsa 20. And then if you try to feed in, without seeing what K is, it somehow detects a pattern in the output here. Whereas if you gave it a uniform random string, then it doesn't say yes. At least there's a noticeable difference in the probabilities of saying yes. It has noticeably more chance of saying yes for salsa 20 than for a uniform random string. Hey, you can't cheat by just having an algorithm that always says yes. In that case, it would always say yes for salsa 20, and it would always say yes for a uniform random string, so the probability gap is zero. What we want for an attack is what's conjectured not to exist, is a reasonably fast attack that distinguishes these from uniform, that says yes much more frequently, noticeably more frequently for these bits of input than for random coin flips, uniform random coin flips. Okay, so what do we have for attacks? Well, let me say something about the cost of brute force, and then move on to the more sophisticated attacks that people have tried. And then I want to say a bit about software speed and then all the alternatives. I've mentioned that stream ciphers are a very active area with many, many, many plausible possibilities. Salsa 20 is maybe the simplest thing out there that we don't have attacks on and still achieves reasonable speed, but there's lots of other things, there are lots of reasonable arguments that we should do something more complicated to get even better speed security trade-offs. I'll try to give you some idea of the design considerations for these functions. If you have some feeling that, well, there's just sort of random collection of operations here, then that's the right feeling to have about these things. They are just random collections of operations, and we don't know how to break them. I'll get more into the philosophy of it when I talk about alternatives. So for the moment, attacks on salsa 20. Let's start with brute force. What do I envision an attacker doing to break salsa 20? If they're faced with somebody using salsa 20 to encrypt, to authenticate data, they're not given the secret key K, well, they can just try guessing it. How many salsa 20s can our CPU do every second? Well, these are the numbers that I worked out before, and depending on your CPU and how much you streamline the key searching computation of salsa 20, it's, let's say, 2 to the 21 salsa 20s per second. Depending, of course, on the exact gigahertz of your processor, it might be 2 to the 23 or 2 to the 19, and depending on what type of processor it is, that'll change things, but everything I'll say is going to be working with much bigger powers of 2, so we won't worry too much about exactly what that number is. Now, let's imagine our very patient attacker, who is also attacking poly 1305, at least trying to, and is willing to spend 30 years doing it. Long attack is 2 to the 30 seconds. By multiplication, we find 2 to the 51 salsa 20 evaluations. And so he tried guessing 2 to the 51 possibilities for the key, maybe starting from 0, or maybe if you say, ha-ha, I'll just stay away from 0 through 2 to the 50 for my keys, well, he might start at some random point or just guess completely random possibilities for each guess, and he ends up guessing 2 to the 51 keys. Total 2 to the 51 keys, well, salsa 20 evaluations. And for each of those, he compares his guess for the key K against what he's actually observing as your authenticators or encrypted results and sees, is that consistent? And probably there's just one key where it's consistent. If he finds the right key of these 2 to the 51 guesses, if one of them is correct, then he's going to notice it's consistent and probably only one of them is probably going to have the right key. So the probability of success here, the probability of finding the right key, is approximately, these approximations are based on conjectures for, depending on the amount of information that the attacker has from, based on K, does that actually uniquely determine K? And we conjecture that if he has, say, 512 bits of information, that's more than enough to pin down what K is. But the problem is he's only tried 2 to the 51 possibilities, the problem for the attacker. So his chance of success is, let's see, 2 to the 51 divided by 2 to the 256 is minus 2 to the 205, which is a rather acceptable security level for the probability of somebody succeeding in attacking the system. But there are all sorts of obvious flaws with this analysis. Question?
If you weren't doing authentication and encryption, you're just doing encryption.
Just encryption.
Or if you were using separate seeds for your encryption and your
authentication.
Yeah. How do you know that you've actually found what you're looking for in your source search?
Well, if you have, how do I say this? Let me ask a question and then address your question after I've answered my own question. So my own question is, suppose that instead of doing something with 256 bits of salsa 20 input, suppose you had 512 bits of salsa 20 input and modified the function to take account of all of those somehow, then wouldn't that reduce the probabilities down to 2 to the minus 500 or so? And yeah, probably they would. If you have more secret bits that you're generating, then subject to the cost of generating those secret bits, and the cost of using them, it's certainly expected that every extra bit of secret key that you generate will improve your security level. If the attacker guesses just part of the key K and tries to see if that's consistent with the unknown possibilities for the rest of the key, then hopefully he can't do that. Hopefully the keys interact, or the pieces of the key, the bits of the key interact in a sufficiently complicated way that the attacker can't just guess part of the key and then check it for consistency with the unknown other part. Now, you were asking, suppose there's separate seeds, separate Ks, separate short shared secrets for, say, encryption and authentication, and that's the same question. Suppose you have more secret data that you start with, then can you tell whether you've correctly guessed just part of the secret data? Again, it's like saying, suppose you had salsa 20 K0 and salsa 20 L0 and simply added them together, or use them for different purposes. Depending on exactly what you do, maybe there is a way to just verify your guess for one part of it and then move on to the other. But if you use them properly, you would hope for a security level that scales with the number of bits you put into your secret key. The reason that I'm not putting more bits into K is simply that this is a good enough security level, although I'm going to criticize in some detail this 2 to the minus 200 something, and I hope that lots of criticisms are popping into your heads. But to answer your question about if you have more secret stuff, then doesn't the attacker have to guess that too, slowing him down? The answer is, yeah, hopefully. If the system's designed properly, then every extra bit in K is going to make the probability of the attacker succeeding even smaller. All right. Are there any observations about the silliness of this analysis where I've said that the attacker is carrying out 2 to the 51 guesses for the key K? He's using only one CPU. Yeah. Now, the analysis here with this 2 to the 51 evaluations, despite appearing in a surprisingly large number of cryptographic papers, does not reflect the reality that the attacker is likely to be equipped with more CPUs than you have. Maybe if you are carrying out an attack equipped only with your laptop, then you are in the situation of being able to do only 2 to the 50 or so evaluations of a medium complexity function. But if your attacker equips himself with more CPUs, then he can, of course, do more guesses for the key in the same amount of time. So let's parallelize this attack, and to figure out how many CPUs the attacker could use in parallel, let's say that each CPU costs about $2 to the $6, and the attacker has about $2 to the $30. Now I'm imagining a pretty low-end CPU here. You probably wouldn't be able to get the latest Intel Core 2 Duo for $64 for some years, but you can get some reasonably fast chips. If you're trying to get the best price-performance ratio, you probably want to go for a CPU, which is something like $2 to the $6. And again, I won't worry about isolated factors of 2 here and there. CPU costs about $2 to the $6. You also have to worry about the cost of the motherboard to put your CPU on and all your energy costs to operate the CPUs, but okay, it's something on this scale. And then how many dollars does the attacker have? Let's imagine a well-funded attacker who has about $2 to $30. What does this mean? There's 2 to the 24 CPUs, and that's certainly within the capabilities of a rich attacker. There are some organizations that already have that number of CPUs, and if they devote them all to evaluating Salsa 20, I'll be quite impressed, they will do 2 to the 75. 2 to the 75 Salsa 20 evaluations, which I should emphasize are all carried out in parallel. There's no obstacle to guessing separate keys on your separate computers, and they each go randomly looking for the key, or partition the range of keys across computers if you like. And now the probability of finding your key K has increased by a factor of 2 to the 24 up to 2 to the minus 181, which is, I would say, still an acceptable security level. But there's more things the attacker can do here. Instead of having, say, what is this, 2 to the 24 sounds like 16 million parallel CPUs, the attacker can say, wait a minute, what am I getting for my $2 to the $30? This is a common question in corporate boardrooms. What I'm getting is 2 to the 24 copies of a floating point unit, which I don't happen to be using at all here, 2 to the 24 copies of a big cache, which is another big chunk of each of these CPUs, and in fact, I'm doing register management, all sorts of stuff which I don't need for Salsa 20, which I could build a very small circuit and evaluate Salsa 20 with much less cost per Salsa 20 evaluation. This machine design is not a reasonable way to carry out cryptanalysis. You can, instead of buying, say, a Pentium and putting most of it to waste, you could buy an FPGA, which runs at a lower clock speed. That's a field programmable gate array, a circuit that's designed to let you reprogram it and make it simulate any circuit at pretty high speed, and then you partition it to have 1,000 Salsa 20s happening in parallel. Or, with this kind of money, $2 to $30, you can build ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits. You can have a huge number of simultaneous computations at the same kind of clock speeds you're used to for a Pentium, maybe even faster, and then all of those Salsa 20 evaluations are happening in parallel for the same kind of cost as your typical Pentium class CPU. Now, the exact evaluation here, I'm going to tell you a power of 2, but it's going to be a little bit fuzzy because evaluating the cost of a computation on a Pentium is substantially easier than evaluating how much it's going to cost to build non-Pentium chips. There's a series of workshops, Special Purpose Hardware for Attacking Cryptographic Systems, SHARCS, if you want to look that up on the web. There have been a few iterations of this workshop, which are all about people figuring out, all right, how expensive are big cryptanalytic computations using, say, FPGAs or building ASICs, special circuits for special chips for your computations, and then how do the algorithms change when you have to worry about putting a lot of parallel computations onto one chip. That's all within the scope of the Sharps workshop. And again, the goal is to figure out the benefit from special purpose hardware without dramatically stretching the technology. I can imagine that the number of Salsa 20 evaluations per chip, instead of being just one at a time, for the same kind of speed, I can imagine 2 to the 15 Salsa 20 evaluations. And I'll put a big question mark by this. 2 to the 15 Salsa 20s per chip at the same time, at the same speed, speeding everything up by a factor of 2 to the 15, just by having 32,000 separate little Salsa 20 units all on the same many million transistor chip that you might have also used to build a Pentium. But this is much more devoted to computing Salsa 20 quickly. And what does that do to the probabilities? Well, now we've got 2 to the 90 Salsa 20 evaluations, maybe. Again, this is a kind of questionable estimate. You could imagine more, you could imagine less, and, well, Sharp's lots of papers evaluating costs of these kinds of things. If it's 2 to the 15 times before, we have 2 to the 90 evaluations of this function. The probability that one of those evaluations was of the right key that the attacker is trying to find has gone up to 2 to the minus 166, which is still not the end of the story. There's one important improvement which is often obscured by the weird terminology of time-memory trade-offs, but let me describe the algorithmic content of this to make clear where you get, for instance, a factor of a billion speed-up from this for free. This is a multiple target attack. What is a target? It is a user. It's a cryptographic key, somebody who's chosen a K. There are lots of users. And I'll just identify them by their keys, K1, K2, through K sub, let's say, a billion users, which actually is less than what we can imagine cryptography doing on the internet. If each computer has a bunch of keys for different purposes, there might actually be a bunch more keys than this, but let's take a billion as a reasonable number of users. Suppose you're given some functions of the keys. I don't care whether it's salsa 20 or some authenticator computed with salsa 20. It's some f of k1, f of k2, et cetera, through f of k sub 2 to the 30. All I need for my estimates is that f is sufficiently close to injective that you can reasonably hope to figure out from the output what the input was. These are just some functions. We're trying to invert these functions, trying to work backwards from, say, salsa 20 of k or some excerpt of salsa 20 of k, trying to work backwards to figure out k, which lets you deduce all the rest of the salsa 20 outputs and forge messages or decrypt data. All right, how do we invert this function f? Well, you could just pick one of the keys and guess k1 and compare all your guesses to f of k1, but here's a much faster attack. What you do is you sort f of k1 and f of k2 and et cetera through f of k2 to the 30, still very easy computation. And then you go ahead with your, say, 2 to the 90 salsa 20 evaluations and throw those into the list and sort those as well, f of 0, f of 1, et cetera, through f of 2 to the 90 minus 1. And then look for collisions in this list. Now, the number of evaluations of f here is only about 2 to the 90. You're given the f of k's as inputs, and then you go ahead and guess 2 to the 90 guesses for your k's, evaluate f. And for those 2 to the 90 evaluations, you're getting 2 to the 120 possibilities of success. You're getting any possible match between the f's will be, after you've sorted this list, adjacent f's that are the same, which you easily detect by running just once through the list. Cheaper than the sorting. Now you might complain, wait a minute, that's a huge amount of data. How do you store all that data? And there's a ton to say about how you can limit the memory for this and you can parallelize it. And it ends up being a little more expensive than attacking a single key. Maybe 10 times more expensive than attacking a single key, but not a billion times more expensive than attacking a single key. And again, the probability of success has increased by a factor of 2 to the 30. So now the probability is, what did I have before? 2 to the minus 181 times 2 to the 15 times another 2 to the 30. And, well, let me emphasize, this is the probability of finding at least one key. And this is now approximately, conjecturally, something like 2 to the minus 166 and a 30 minus 136. Double-checked, is that what I calculated before? Okay. 2 to the minus 136. Now, this is still an acceptable security level. Even if some of my estimates are off somewhat, even if computers get faster, chips get cheaper, attackers have more money, attackers have more time. I heard at the quantum cryptography workshop here that someone was trying to advertise quantum cryptography, which is very expensive, but if you're really trying to protect your information, maybe it's something you're willing to pay for. And he was talking to somebody, a potential customer, who was a member of the British royal family. who said to him, you know, you don't have to explain to me the importance of protecting data, secret data, for 100 years. We're the royal family. We understand. This is important. And so, okay, you could imagine attacks would take longer, and over 20 years, probably CPUs won't get a whole lot faster in terms of how fast the individual circuits are switching times, but they probably will get a lot cheaper. But there's still some room between 2 to the minus 136 and something that an attacker actually has a noticeable chance of succeeding at. Even if there's more users, there's a lot of wiggle room here. With this 256 bits of security, I'd say we're at a comfortable security level, even if some of the estimates change considerably. I wouldn't say the same if I'd started with a 128-bit key. I do not recommend using 128-bit keys, or God forbid, the 80-bit keys that some people have talked about. It's just not that hard to do 2 to the 80 guesses for a key, especially if you have multiple users. There's a paper exploring how easy that computation would be against one 80-bit cipher. But, okay, 256 bits seems like enough. Also, as I'll get into tomorrow morning, the scaling between, say, 128 bits of security and 256 bits of security doesn't seem so bad, so it seems perfectly reasonable to say we're not going to spend too much more to go to 256 bits and not have to worry about an attacker actually figuring out the key, unless there's a better attack, a bigger probability of success from the attacker doing something more sophisticated. And this is where people have started looking at, oops, I got rid of the diffusion pictures thanks to the screensaver, but people start looking at the structure of SALSA 20, staring deeply at not just the three-round diagram, but the four-round and five-round diagram, and after a while you begin to notice that there's a little greenish spot there, which is probably some sort of defect in SALSA 20. No, seriously, people have actually broken some number of rounds, and I want to tell you what these more sophisticated attacks do with proper references. So, okay, first of all, to formulate the question, compared to brute force, the question is, are there better attacks? To put a precise cost limit on it, you might say, all right, suppose we have an attacker who can pay for maybe as many as 2 to the 64 parallel key searching circuits. That's a huge computer, bigger than the attacks I've been talking about here, including the multiple target one if you limit the memory, use the fancier algorithms for it. Let's imagine the attacker might be able to get up to 2 to the 64, but not further. And let's imagine the attacker has a ridiculous amount of time because circuits have gotten a lot faster somehow and might spend as many as 2 to the 128 SALSA 20 evaluations over those parallel circuits, so overall 2 to the 192 SALSA 20 evaluations, which is a lot more than the 2 to the 90 we did before, then can the attacker reach a probability of success that is significantly bigger than what brute force achieves, which is, well, comparing 2 to the 256 to the 2 to the 64 and 2 to the 128, hopefully the three numbers I've written down without the minus signs and the powers of 2 add up to 256. And I also have to multiply by the number of users. This is the distinguishing chance, the probability that the attack succeeds. Can we get probability significantly better than what brute force achieves? And U here is the number of users, U targets. The concrete SALSA 20 security conjecture is that no, there are no better attacks, nothing that accomplishes this. If I reduced 20 rounds down to, say, 3 rounds, then clearly this would not be a reasonable conjecture. And, well, after I offered $1,000 for the most interesting cryptanalysis of anything even vaguely like SALSA 20, I ended up awarding it to Paul Crowley, who had an attack on SALSA 20/5, which, to repeat the notation from before, this is SALSA 20 reduced to 5 rounds. And the performance of his distinguisher I think it could also be used to find the key, but in any case, it was a clear attack on Salsa 20, whose overall price-performance ratio, let's multiply the cost times the time, divide by the probability of success, and that ended up being, for his attack, about 2 to the 165. Something like guessing 160 bits of the key and then going through some very easy computation for each key on 5-round Salsa 20 would succeed in detecting a pattern in the output. So if you go through all 2 to the 160 guesses for those 160 bits of the key, then after 2 to the 165 operations, you have detected a pattern in the output. And then there's been an improvement by a bunch of people, which is going to appear at Endocrypt, this year in 2006, December, Fisher, Robshaw, various people had an attack a little more expensive, pushing it one more round to 6-round Salsa 20 with maybe 2 to the 177 operations to reliably break it, 2 to the 177 evaluations of something like Salsa 20. The way these attacks work is, well, very much by staring at these pictures and saying, okay, what happens after 3 or 4 rounds? And well, I have a little bit of commentary on how these attacks work. If you have any sort of function that goes through any chain of operations, as all functions do, then what you can try is saying, okay, suppose we change the input a little bit. Then that won't have such a big change on the next intermediate result, and it won't have such a big change on the next result. Exactly the kinds of pictures I've been drawing, supplemented by the computer doing guesswork for, suppose you guessed 160 bits of the key, then you can guess more of what's going to happen inside the computation. And that's how these attacks work. This is how probably half of the stream cipher and block cipher crypt analyses work in the literature, is what are called differential attacks. Basically, you look at a small difference in the inputs, in the ends, and you choose your difference to try to push the attack as far as you can, try to optimize all the parameters, and that's what the recent paper, Endocrypt 2006, does better than Paul Crowley's paper. It's just optimizing things better, but same basic idea. If you look at some n's that are pretty close together, like I tried varying the first byte of n, and then I was trying to write a sentence here. A small difference in n's has some chance, let's say a pretty good chance, noticeable chance, of producing a predictable difference. Somewhere, there's a few bits after some number of rounds. In Salsa 20, after, let's say, 3 or 4 rounds, depending on how well optimized you've gotten it. And actually, for 3 rounds, well, you just see that from the picture here. Here's the predictable parts of the 3-round result. And then to push that to 5 or 6 rounds, you can say, well, you can kind of work backwards from the result. If you guess parts of the key, then, well, the key has some influence on the output, and if you strip away part of that influence, you can kind of work backwards a round or two, and, well, push this to 5 or 6 rounds by guessing some parts of the key. Not the entire key, that would take 2 to the 256 operations, but just guessing part of the key means that you can predict what this little difference is going to do in the next round. It's going to make some comprehensible difference in the next round, being not influenced by the key, and then some comprehensible difference in the next round. And finally, you look at the 5th or 6th round at the output of Salsa 20/5 or 6 and say that, well, all of the difference is affecting some parts of the words, which if we have guessed the relevant parts of the keys, then we can check whether we have the right difference. All right, this is a typical attack on a stream cipher, on a block cipher. This is if you have any sort of formulas that produce any sort of output and you want to detect some structure in the output, this is the first thing to try, is looking at what happens if you change the input a little bit. And simple operations tend to convert little changes into maybe bigger changes, but not gigantic changes. So hopefully you can push this some distance. But I see no hope of pushing this all the way to salsa 20. And in fact, after the original attacks, it's always dangerous to think through cryptanalysis for yourself. You might be missing something really basic. Good to have lots of other people look at it. But after my feelings about the security of salsa 20 were to some extent confirmed by other people looking and saying, well, okay, maybe we can break 5, 6, maybe 7 rounds. Well, here's a challenge, is to break salsa 20/8. Purely for speed, after the original salsa 20, and after Crowley's attack, purely for speed, I propose salsa 20/8 or /12 as some intermediate possibilities that if you want to make things twice as fast and still unbroken, then hey, use a lot fewer rounds. And this is about as conservative as AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, where there are some attacks going up to something like 7 rounds, depending on exactly what your cost limits are for the attacker. AES has 10 rounds, and 7 are clearly broken, which if you thought of those rounds as being like 2 salsa 20 rounds, then that would be as if someone had broken 14 rounds of salsa 20, which is much farther than what I think is doable. I think salsa 20 goes a lot farther than AES does, and I expect it over time to engender a lot more confidence than AES does. And similar comments, so there are a lot of stream ciphers out now. The latest generation of stream ciphers just do more work than AES does, and they inspire more confidence in their security, at least some of them. There are also some that people publish functions and the functions are promptly broken, but there's definitely functions like salsa 20 that have resisted attack. Okay, I have a few things that I want to do, and I have a few minutes left. Let me, of the various options, defer till tomorrow the speed/design discussion of salsa 20. I'm going to merge the discussion of how fast salsa 20 software is, how you actually go through these operations versus, okay, what if you change the operations? Natural question when you look at any of these stream ciphers. We should see what some alternatives are, and I've got some thoughts about talking about that, and that'll be the end of stream cipher day early tomorrow, and then I'll get into elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. But I also have, and I've been delaying this too long, wanted to peek at the course webpage for purposes of people who are looking at the projects and say what stuff I put up there over the weekend. Before I abandon salsa 20 until tomorrow, are there questions about what I've said so far about salsa 20? Yeah? Well, salsa 20... Standards. So AES was the result of a competition that started in, I believe, 1998. I think submissions were sometime around 1998. And there were 15 serious submissions, of which 5, after years of review, were selected as these are NIST and NSA were reviewing the candidates, lots of public discussions, conferences, people talking about what they wanted from a block cipher. And after a few years, AES, out of the 5 leading candidates, AES was selected as the standard. They said at the beginning of the process, this will be a multi-year process, after which we will point to A-Cypher as being the new advanced encryption standard. And one of the submissions, Rheindel, was apparently better than the others. And according to the criteria, there's a paper by Nechvatal and various other people at NIST that went through 50 pages of criteria for here's why we're selecting this function over some others. And then that's been a standard for several years now and is very widely implemented, and people are quite confident in its security up to the limits of its security conjecture, that it seems to have enough rounds that people are comfortable with it, at least for 128 bits of security, and then 128 bits gets you into trouble for maybe brute force attacks, but it has a 256-bit option, and it only has 128-bit blocks, which causes trouble for collisions in the blocks. But, well, people don't worry about those too much because people aren't thinking very much about what if we do, say, 2 to the 50 blocks of encryption. So AES has held up pretty well. It's running into a bit of trouble from a side channel attack perspective, and Again, it has some limits on how much security it can provide, but it's doing okay, except for speed. The latest generation of stream ciphers, some of the stream ciphers out there are aiming for better security than AES. In the case of Salza 20, I really ramped up the rounds to not just my security conjecture is stronger than the AES one, but I left a lot more room than the AES designers did. I could have done Salsa 20 with 10 rounds and still felt like, okay, this is as conservative as anything else people are doing, but I went all the way to 20 rounds because that's still faster than AES. You can get a better speed security trade-off, thanks to the issues I'll talk about tomorrow, just by paying better attention to, okay, what are the needs of the applications, what does the stream cipher have to do, and what are our resources, what do the CPUs do to let us accomplish what the users need. Okay, so then what is the status of Salsa 20 and the other, the new generation of stream ciphers? Well, eCrypt, the eCrypt stream cipher project, a couple years ago asked for candidates. I should emphasize this is not officially a competition to select a stream cipher. If you look at the description, then the eCrypt stream cipher project is a multi-year effort to identify new stream ciphers that might become suitable for widespread adoption. And in all their announcements, they've clearly said, well, we're going to try to collect information and see what ciphers people are interested in and what we can figure out about their security. I would not expect eStream to point to one stream cipher at the end of it. You can see there's tons and tons of papers, 53 papers here, and that's just in 2006. Let's see if we can find 2005 in this list. Papers. Some of these are attack papers, and some of them are design papers here, 85 papers in 2005, plus how many was it, 53 this year? So more than 100 papers, including lots of cryptanalysis of these ciphers. And then, all right, after the first year or so, some of these ciphers were selected as for software being the most attractive ones. And then, well, there's a lot for hardware, as I've mentioned. There's a lot to be done in figuring out the hardware cost of a lot of ciphers. There's some that are clearly, like Trivium is clearly very low cost in hardware. But anyway, for high security levels, none of the ciphers listed in the hardware focus list are aiming for the same 256-bit security level as, say, Salsa 20 or Lex with a 256-bit key or HC256. There are several designs here that are all, well, there's a group of stream cipher people who pointed to some of the submissions of the 30-something submissions, said these are the ones that have survived cryptanalysis so far and seem attractive from a speed perspective. And maybe after some more investigation, people will say, well, PY, for example, actually pronounced Rue for Cyrillic, actually that's been thoroughly broken after this list was made. And so that's going to be chopped off the list. And then I'm more than a little bit skeptical about Lex. I wouldn't be surprised if that loses favor to the extent that people are interested in it. But Felix looks like a very attractive candidate. HC256 is very big, uses a lot of memory, but aside from that, it is very, very fast. And there's lots of people looking at these and saying, well, okay, are these suitable replacements for AES? Again, I wouldn't expect eCrypt to point to any single one and say this is the one that we're recommending for anybody, but probably there will be some list of five that are attractive, and I really wouldn't want to predict what's going to happen. My own taste in writing cryptographic software for speed reasons and for high security goals have been leaning more and more away from AES. When I talk about design tomorrow, I'll say something about cache timing attacks, which for me were the final straw in saying AES is just not a good design. But anyway, there's several plausible possibilities. Again, intense competition here. There are lots of good new stream ciphers that for a year or two or three, all these are fairly new ciphers, have held up against attack. And if they continue holding up, people will build confidence in them as they have in AES. In the case of Salsa 20, well, I really tried to overkill from a security perspective while keeping it faster than AES. So I expect that to rapidly gain confidence from the community, if it hasn't already. And similarly, for there are several of the designs here which I like, and I can easily imagine people choosing to use them. Having said that, users really do like having a single standard and pointing to something and saying, okay, everybody should use this. it devotes the community's resources to just one cipher instead of a lot, and right now AES has all that interest. So I don't know what's going to happen. The situation right now, well, I can easily say, all right, these are all new ciphers, and just like Rue has been thoroughly broken now, other things could be crossed off the list. I feel quite confident in SALSA 20 more than in AES, but who knows? Maybe somebody will find an attack, and maybe somebody will find better attacks against AES. So there's always risks when we leave the realm of provably secure cryptography. Does that answer, or at least partially answer, your question? Okay. Let me pop over to the course webpage. And just to say what I've added here over the past weekend, I had some lists of what I did during the first week. But after that, okay, so starting beginning of the weekend, I had a new Chasm release. And for those of you who are doing Chasm programming, I strongly recommend getting the latest version. Among other things, it's not just for the x86, although I know some of you are using Pentiums and Athlons and so on. There's also been requests for PowerPC, and, well, current Chasm still needs lots of testing, but it has at least nominal support for the PowerPC, and slight syntax changes which you should read about to particularly make PowerPC easier to understand the instructions. And then I started doing, most of the rest of what's on the webpage now, is what I'll start talking about tomorrow, namely Curve 25519, elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. But instead of thinking about the application of that to cryptography, what's on the web page is the implementation side of, okay, here's a software engineering example of doing arithmetic modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19. Simple concept, addition, multiplication, mod 2 to the 255 minus 19. But how do we actually build working software, even to constrain this more working floating point software that does these computations? And I've got some paragraphs on, okay, deciding how exactly an integer is represented as a sum of floating point numbers, and then spending a remarkable number of lines talking about addition and giving some simple C code for addition, and then breaking it down into machine operations, still with C code, doing some loads and additions and stores, and then translating everything to Chasm at some point after doing the final translation in C. Then Chasm code is essentially the same as the final C code. And also showing a test program. Even for something as simple as addition, I always write a little test program so I'm confident that it works, and if I make any changes later, I can rerun the test and gain the same confidence that I haven't made any silly mistakes. Even just doing one addition and checking it produces the right results, which incidentally I check the way the test programs work, as you can read here in some detail, look at the code. The way the test programs work is by doing a random input and printing out the inputs and then adding them with this addition function and then printing out the sum along with GP instructions to say, please subtract the sum from the output. And GP recomputes the sum, standard number theory calculator, GP. It rechecks the computation. So I can just run the output through GP to make sure it's producing the right results. I don't want to have to by hand add 255-bit numbers. And then continuing the weekend, I did, along with some links to the code if you want to download and compile, got the instructions here, did subtraction, woohoo, subtraction, and finally multiplication. And multiplication, you can see some huge list here, which is just the coefficients of a polynomial product with some appropriate indexing, and then writing code for that. I didn't bother with C code. Actually, before writing the code, I've got some longer discussion here of Karatsuba's method, which saves a little bit of time for a 12-coefficient polynomial multiplication, and a careful discussion of exactly what's going on in Karatsuba's method. And then finally, test program happens somewhere here. Oh, yeah, discussion of more of the how do you actually go ahead and handle Karatsuba's method, how do you put a constant into the UltraSpark. And finally, here's the Chasm code for multiplication with a bunch of variable definitions, and eventually gets around to actually loading something. The variables here are names for the products of some inputs, which is why there's a lot of them, because there's a lot of separate products. And finally, there's some loads, and, well, okay, you can read the code, and some test software. And then squaring, which is faster than general multiplication. Reduction, here I've separated the squaring of an integer from reducing it mod 2 to the 255 minus 19 is the prime in this case, where you can see multiplications by 19 times 2 to the minus 255 that affects a reduction. Modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19 and test software for that, and then carrying and go through all the details of floating point carrying. So if you're trying to do something like this, and I've really tried to explain all the details here of how you do the basic operations, and along with each of those, I've measured the lower bounds, the number of floating point additions, number of floating point multiplications, which I strongly recommend that you do, along with writing sequences of instructions. You should count, which I did with the computer's help, just searching for floating point additions, floating point multiplications, count how many additions and multiplications there are. And that tells you that, for instance, multiplication and carrying and reduction, a complete multiplication mod 2 to the 255 minus 19, the bottleneck there is 177 floating point additions, at least 177 cycles. And then continuing the weekend, did a few more operations you need for this particular computation. Conversion to floating point, which I've said very little about in class, but if you actually want to write the software, it's good to see exactly how to do that, and conversion out of floating point. And finally, the total computation. There's some complexity of the main loop here, which I'll say more about. This starts getting into the high levels of how elliptic curve cryptography works. There's some sequence of additions and multiplications, which is a little bit fancy, but okay, that's something that I just copied from the relevant papers. And then this was working software, and I counted the number of floating point additions in it, number of floating point multiplications, and then I timed it. And here was the bad news so far. Compared to 400,000 floating point additions, the software was actually taking 2 million cycles. Sometimes a little bit longer because the machine was handling a network packet, doing something else, but it was typically taking 2 million cycles, which is a factor of 5 between the number of floating point additions and the number of floating point, the number of UltraSpark cycles taken. Whereas I've shown you examples of software which is taking just 1 cycle per floating point addition. So obviously there's some room for improvement, and this is the end of the page so far, aside from a list of what I did yesterday, and I'm going to be adding what I did today. What I have to add, continuing to this, and I'll say more about curve 25519 when I start it tomorrow, what I have to say to continue this is, okay, you've written working software for doing some computation, and it's taking, there's a big gap between your lower bound for how long that software has to take and your upper bound, the amount of time the software does take. Then how do you get rid of that? Well, that's what I'll be continuing to add to the webpage and discuss something about the software engineering in class. But in any case, for getting something working, this is always my first step of, okay, don't worry about speed, just write some software that uses the right floating point operations and make sure it does the right thing, which is also tested here, all sorts of test code for this elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman stuff, and then worry about making it fast, worry about reducing the code down to just doing one floating point addition every cycle with no other delays. So those of you who are doing projects in particular with floating point arithmetic, but in general anything with assembly language, or just working with big integers, splitting them up in any sort of way into smaller integers, you should find this useful in understanding the engineering process for creating working cryptographic software. Okay, so I wanted to show you that web page, and then tomorrow, sorry for going over time again, but tomorrow I will be getting into what else do I have to say about SALSA 20. Ah, yes, I have to tell you about the speed and the design of SALSA 20, and give you some idea of the many other functions out there which are also quite suitable for use as stream ciphers, give you some idea of how easy it is to design a function like this. Not just simple to write down, but you really don't have to watch out for very much. I'll get into all that tomorrow and then jump into Diffie-Hellman. So I'll see everybody tomorrow at 11 o'clock.